Hey, good evening. Thank you so much. I'm so honored to be the first speaker for this new Roses Are Best initiative. So nice. Thank you, Karen Simon, for inviting me to speak, and thank you to all the sponsors, and thank you to the Orleans for hosting. So as it's Rosh Chodesh Adar, again, this time for real, so to speak, I wanted to talk about Megillas Esther, but not so much the text of the Megillah itself, but more sort of the behind the scenes, the ideas in Chazal, and the Midrashim, and the Gemaras that fill in the details of the story that aren't found specifically in the text itself of the Gemara. So I'm sure we're all in the Megillah. So I'm sure we're all familiar with these different Midrashim Chazal, but just to run through some of them that come up in the first parak. So we know that Yirmiyahu HaNavi had a nevuah that after 70 years, of Babel, of Galus Babel were fulfilled. It's unclear what that means, but after 70 years, the Jewish people would leave Galus Babel, would return to the land of Israel, and begin rebuilding the Beis HaMikdash. And you know that all the non-Jewish kings in whose dominion the Jews were under were always worried and calculating when are these 70 years going to be over, because the Gemara tells us that they were worried that when the Jews returned to Israel and rebuilt the Beis HaMikdash, that would be their downfall, right? When the Jews left Mitzrayim, of course, it wasn't so great for the Mitzrayim. So the Gemara Megillah explains that Ahasuerus was also calculating, and in fact the big party that he throws at the beginning of the Megillah is because he had calculated that the 70 years were up, the Jews were not redeemed, he personally stopped the building of the Beis HaMikdash, which had begun by his predecessor, Koresh. Ahasuerus stopped the building, and he threw a big party to celebrate the fact that the Jews were not being redeemed and the Beis HaMikdash was not being built. And Chazal go on to explain that, to emphasize this point, Ahasuerus wore the clothing of the Kohen Gadol, he served the wine and goblets and vessels from the Beis HaMikdash. Vashti, right, grandson of Nebuchadnezzar, did the same thing, and that for this reason Mordechai forbade the Jews from going to the party. And then Chazal continue and explain that Jews did go to the party, they enjoyed themselves, right, at this party to celebrate that the Beis HaMikdash was not being rebuilt, and because of this they deserved this terrible decree that was decreed against them. Right, and also in terms of Vashti, we're all familiar with all the ideas in the Midrashei Chazal and the Gemara, the Agadita, the background about Vashti, that Vashti was a wicked woman. Why did she refuse to go to Ahasuerus' party? So these are children's favorites. Either one idea, she became covered with Sara'as, she broke out in leprosy, or another idea, everyone's, you know, most memorable childhood memory, that Vashti grew a tail, and that's always a fun costume addition. Right, and because of this, she couldn't attend the party. She ends up being killed, and Chazal explained why she deserved to be killed. So they fill in the lines, because she was a wicked woman. She forced the Jewish girls to work on Shabbos. She humiliated them by making them work on Shabbos naked. And because of this, Mida Keneged Mida, she was called on Shabbos to appear naked in front of the party. She refused to do so, and she was killed. Interestingly, another idea is that she was the one who convinced her husband Ahasuerus to stop the building of the Beis HaMikdash. Right, she was the granddaughter of Nebuchadnezzar, and she said to her husband, like, honey, how could it be that you're rebuilding what my ancestor destroyed? Right, that doesn't work out, so he stopped. And because she was the one who stopped him, she deserved to be killed. So, and again, none of this is clear from the main text of the Megillah. When you're reading, one summer I worked with a non-religious Israeli woman, and she was highly insulted. Something came up about Purim, and we were sort of explaining the different characters to some non-Jewish people who were there, and I referred to Vashti as the wicked queen, and this woman got very insulted. How could you say that? Ma pitzom, she was the first feminist. She refused, she was killed because she disobeyed her husband. She's a heroine. She's like if I would dress all my daughters as Vashti if I was religious, you know, like, she was so insulted. And the truth is, if you don't have the traditions of Chazal behind the text, the behind the scenes, so then the truth is, from the text, Vashti's just this unfortunate woman who doesn't give in to these outrageous demands of her drunk husband, and she ends up dead. Right? But of course, we have these ideas of Chazal that fill in all the background. So it's interesting, what I'm always fascinated with in terms of Midrashim, different Agadita, the ideas of Chazal are sort of how we're supposed to understand them. Right? Are they meant to be taken literally? Did Vashti literally grow a tail? Or is this somehow figurative, right? Is this not meant to be taken literally? And of course, this is discussed This is a very old question. It's discussed in the Gaonim. The Rishonim take different opinions on it. It's a hot topic today in the blogosphere for anyone who reads those types of blogs. And it comes up because practically, it's an important question in terms of education. How do you present Midrashim to students in school? Right? Do you present them as incredibly literal, that this is what happens, right? This is what Chazal say, and this is what happened, even if it sounds sort of out there? Or do you not present it at all? Do you present it as a mashal? And of course, we don't know sort of what's a mashal, what's not a mashal. So interestingly, just because we're in the neighborhood, Rav Hirsch was asked this question in a summer correspondence. We have some letters that went back and forth. Apparently the questioner wasn't so happy with the initial response that he got. So we have this letter back and forth. Rav Hirsch was asked this question about teaching Midrashim in school to young children, these different agadotas. And one of Rav Hirsch's concerns, which is just interesting, is that if you present young children with ideas of Midrashim and you present them as very literal, then this becomes part of their belief system. So as much as, Rav Hirsch was going to give this example, it's my example, but I guess as much as sort of in their minds, Kriyas Yamsuf happens, so Batya's hands, you know, stretched out however many, you know, however far, and she was able to take the Teva Moshe, and that's something that happens. And Rav Hirsch was worried that as people grow up and mature and become more learned, when they would come across the writings of the Gaonim and some Rishonim that say that many Midrashim are not meant to be taken literally, many are Mashalim, they happened in dreams, they're parables, they're metaphors. So this would sort of shake the belief system of a person who is raised on these stories, which I can personally attest to. Right? If this is something you sort of grow up on, to then hear at a later point in life, oh, it's not really meant literally, right? It didn't necessarily happen that way, so that could be sort of shocking. So anyway, that's sort of a parenthetical, but again, this is a very old question, and some different mefarshim and rishonim deal with it, the question of how to understand midrashim, different agados, in Chazal, and specifically here with Midrash Esther, we have so much behind the scenes. There's so much that Chazal fill in that's not in the text, so it's just interesting to see how the different mefarshim deal with it. So we're going to be looking tonight at sort of a parish that most people are probably not familiar with, the parish of Rav Elezer of Worms. But before I get to that, just sort of as a foil, I want to discuss the Ibn Ezra for a moment, so you don't have it on your sheets. But just to give you an example of, let's say, how Mefarash would deal with these midrashim. So let's say when it comes to Ibn Ezra, in general, the Ibn Ezra has a very varied, very nuanced view of the midrashim, the Midrashei Chazal. He takes some literally, some not literally. He has a whole system. But so too, when we go to Esther, just to give you some examples, there's some midrashim that the Ibn Ezra accepts as literal. He presents them that way. So the idea that Haman was wearing an idol, and that's why Mordechai wouldn't bow down. So the Ibn Ezra presents that as that's what happens. An example of something that he mentions but sort of rejects is the idea that this idea that Ahasuerus' party celebrated that the Jews weren't being redeemed. So he mentions it, but then he gives sort of his own opinion, like, but I prefer, you know, a sort of a different view. And then interestingly, one that he presents but explains non-literally is the tale. The Ibn Ezra says that Chazal say that Avriel HaMalach gave Vashti a tale, so it's not meant literally. It means that Hashem made her ugly, right? Hashem made her repulsive in the eyes of Ahasuerus, like the same way that an animal with a tail would be unattractive, so that's how Hashem made her unattractive, right? I guess in English we would use the word beastly, like she looked like an animal, right? Not literally, she didn't literally have a tail, but Hashem made it so she would be unattractive so that she wouldn't want to go out. This actually is not found in Ibn Ezra's printed Perush. If you go to look it up, it's not there. Ibn Ezra wrote two Perushim to Esther, as he wrote two Perushim to many things. I actually didn't realize that he wrote two Perushim to Esther, so I was working on a paper dealing only with one Perush, and then, sorry, personal reflection. And then it came up in this article that he wrote two, and it was like the middle of the night, and I was so panicked, like I've only been working on one, and there's another one. So I sent out my poor husband at 11 o'clock at night to go to the YU library and photocopy it for me. And I felt like one of those stories of like the pregnant woman with the cravings, like, you must get me the watermelon. I don't care that it's the winter, you know? I was like, I need this Ibn Ezra from the alternate version. And he was so good, and he got it for me. And then it wasn't even there either. Because this idea with the tail is actually, it's found in a manuscript version of the second parish. So anyway, so that's one example of how people, different person, let's say Ibn Ezra, deal with these different midrashim. But the parish that I want to look at again tonight is the parish of Rav Elezer Meworms, and you see that I called it between the lines or between the letters, and we'll talk about what that means. So just a little background. Rav Elazar of Worms lived, he wrote the famous, his famous halachic work is the Ropeach, the Sefer HaRopeach, so it's often called the Ropeach. He lived at the end of the 12th and the beginning of the 13th century, and he was one of the major figures of the Hasidei Ashkenaz movement, the specific movement in Ashkenaz. He's one of the Balei Tosfos. In his personal life, he lived just sort of in the aftermath of the Third Crusade, and he was affected personally. His house was stormed by two crusaders who killed his wife and his two daughters and injured himself and his son. He survived, but we actually have a very moving kina, like a lamentation, a poem that he wrote for his wife and for his two daughters, and he bases it around Eshet Chayil, and he writes about his wife, but based on the words of Eshet Chayil, and it's incredibly sad, obviously, but I also, as a Jewish woman, I find it very inspiring to hear how he describes his wife and who she was and what she did, sort of what you can live up to. You know, he describes how she, you know, she fed all the yeshiva students and she worked to support him and she was always davening and saying Tehillim and Divrei Torah and she fixed all the svarim and the shul and in the, you know, the Beis Medrash. And she, what else did she do? She was the first one in shul, the last one out of shul. You know, just very, she taught her daughters how to daven. So it's a very moving tribute of a father to his daughters and a husband to his wife. Anyway, so Rav Elazar of Worms was also, he was the student of the famous Rabbi Yehuda Chassid of the Hasidic Ashkenaz movement. So Rabbi Yehuda Chassid, right, who authored Sefer Hasidim, which is why everyone on their Sayyid Sinai profiles have to write their father's name, or the guys have to write their mother's name, because Rabbi Yehuda Chassid said not to marry someone who has the same name as, anyway. So Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid taught Rav Elazar of Worms this, I actually have a friend whose father's name is Abba, so it came up on a date because she had put down father's name Abba, and the guy on the date is like, you know, you don't have to, it's not what you call your father, it's like your father's actual name. She's like, no, my father's name is Abba. He's like, no, I know, but really, you know, they sort of both came out thinking the other person was like not all there. So Rav Elazar of Worms actually received this sod tradition from Rabbi Yehuda Chassid. Rabbi Yehuda Chassid taught him this esoteric tradition that was passed, you know, from student, from teacher to student, passed down. And after Rabbi Yehuda Chassid died in 1217, Rav Elazar of Worms started to write down these teachings, right? They were previously only kept oral, these mystical teachings, but Rabbi Elazar of Worms writes, sort of very bleak. His Rebbe had died, his son had died, and he felt that there was no one to pass these on to, so he had to write them down, sort of Eis Lasos L'Hashem. Even though he had students, he felt they would be lost. So one of the first books that he wrote down with these esoteric teachings is called Sefer HaChachma. And I'm getting the sheets. Sefer HaChachma deals with, it has 73 gates, sha'arim, and each one is a way of interpreting the Torah. It's a tool that if you use this tool and you apply it to Chumash, you'll come out with the secrets of the soul, the secrets of the mystical tradition, specifically if you apply it to Bereshis. And Rav Elazar of Worms uses these tools and applies them to Megillas Esther. So I just wanted to read the first one on your source sheet. If you see number one from Sefer HaChachma, it says with the third gate is the gate of Gematria. The third tool to apply to Chumash is Gematria, right? Numerology, counting up the letters and seeing what they equal. So he says, Kaf ta'asel Torah. This is the way you should do the Torah, v'timtza ma'ashamru chachamim. Right? If you apply gematria to the Torah, you'll come out with what the chachamim said, o b'midrash, o b'talmud, either in the medrash or in the Talmud, al yedei gematria, o al yedei remiza. Right? Either if you apply gematria or these other tools to the Torah, what will emerge? What Chazal said. What Chazal said either in the medrash or in the Gemara. A fascinating idea. Right? He goes on, ki mi'ika mizi zelo Remiza Moshe Belraisa, right? Is there anything that Moshe didn't hint to in the Torah? No, everything's in the Torah, even if it's hidden. And if you apply these rules, it'll come out to you. So, and just, you see that they were really into Gematria, the Chassidei Ashkenaz. Sefer HaChachma, I said, has 73 gates. Chachma actually equals 73, if you calculate it out. So Sefer HaChachma is the book of 73 gates. Anyway, so Rav Elazar of Worms applies these rules to the actual wording of the Megillah and shows how the ideas of Chazal that we said are sort of behind the scenes are really hinted to in the actual words of the Megillah. So I wanted to go through some examples, not the whole Megillah, very long, it's the Megillah. We're going to just go through the first parak, where he brings a few examples. So the Megillah begins, Vayhi b'me'ach Hashverosh, and you know it's repetitive. It says, Vayhi b'me'ach Hashverosh, Hu'ach Hashverosh. right? And the Gemara asks, why is it repeat this? So the Gemara has a drasha that it wasn't the days of Achashverosh, she was Achashverosh, that Achashverosh remained the same throughout the story of the Megillah. He started out wicked, and even at the end where he seems like a nice guy and he lets the Jews live and he appoints Mordechai and so on, he was still a wicked person, right? So, and if you look, what Rav Elazar of Worms says is he shows that the words after the colon, that he, if you calculate the words bimei Achashverosh hu Achashverosh, it equals, the Gemashre equals hu birisho mitchilaso viat sofo. He was wicked from his beginning to his end, which is the words of the Gemara, right? And that all equals 1,716. So pretty cool. But you have an idea of Chazal, and here he shows how that's actually hinted to in the actual words of the Megillah. And if you go to the next example, the Megillah says the story is happening, Kisheves HaMelech, and he says, Kisheves HaMelech Gematria Mishivim Shana. It equals from 7 years, 7 years from the exile. Right, this idea of Chazal that it was now 70 years in, or what he considered to be the 70th year. So both of those phrases, Kisheves HaMelech and Mishivim Shana, equal 817. Okay, very good. And the next idea is not a Gematria, but it's another one of the Sha'arim. There's a Sha'ar of big and small letters, that you learn something when in the Torah or any one of the Kisei Kodesh, when there's a letter that we have a Masorah that you write it very large or you write it very small, it comes to teach us something. So he says, when he's talking about the different fabrics that they used at the party, right, Chur Karpasus Kleles, so Chur is always written with a big Ches. So Rav Elazar Worms writes, Lermos Shalavash Ches Big Zei Kuhuna. It hints that Achashverosh were the eight, Ches is equals eight, the eighth begadim of the Kohen Gadol, right? So the Megillah is actually hinting to you, this idea of Chazal with this big chest, that Achashverosh was wearing the eighth begadim of the Kohen Gadol, right? So for another Meforash, right, this is an idea of Chazal that's sort of totally separate from Megillah. For Rav Elazar of Worms, it's right here, it's hinted to right here in the words. There's a huge chest, right, staring out at you and waving. If you look at the next one, number five, it says, V'haskos v'klei zahav, the drinks were served in golden goblets, and on those words, the Gemara explains that the kelim from the Beit HaMikdash were used, right? Let's say someone like Ibn Ezra doesn't mention this at all, right? It's not in the pshat, it's not something that's apparent. So for Rav Elazar of Worms, it's right there, right? V'haskos v'klei zahav equals 893, it's the same Gematria as El Beit HaMikdash, right? That Achashverosh commanded his servants to bring him kelim from the Beit HaMikdash. Okay, so you might notice that the first one equals 893 and the second one equals 892. Okay, oops. So if you look at number six, it's okay. Rav Elazar Worms explains in the Shar HaGematrios, V'inyaksar l'cha aleph obeys min haminyan. If you're missing one or two when you do the count, it's okay. Min haminyan b'gematria, shelo yishbebaza, right? It doesn't equal exactly. In kateza, right? We're not so mafbit on this. Kiyish rayami pasuk afer. Right, you can always find a hint to another pasuk if he doesn't get too nervous, if it doesn't equal exactly. So as you'll see, if it's off one or two numbers, it's considered equal. Okay, just as long as we get that straight. Okay, now number seven, Batsimaim. Vashti refuses to come to the party. And we said there were two different ideas of Chazal. Either she was covered with tzara'as or she grew a tail. So you might say, oh, there are two. Which one is correct? That's okay. He finds a hint for both. Batsimain, so he says the word Batsimain, Vashti Lavo, equals Gematria Shaparach Batsaras, that she blossomed, right? She broke out in Saras. And similarly, Batsimain alone equals Gematria Az Asala Zanav, then she grew a tail. So you notice I made question marks. This is actually found, this parish is not found in his printed edition, it's found in a manuscript, and I'm not sure how it equals each other. So any math people in the room who could figure out when I did it, it didn't equal. But again, there are many rules in the Gematria that Rav Elazar Worms outlines. Sometimes you only calculate everything minus the first letter of the word. Sometimes you write all the letters out full. There are like a lot of rules. So I don't know how he saw this equal one another, but he says it does. So either way, the important thing is that Rav Elazar Worms saw both of these ideas of Chazal hinted to in the actual word, Batsimain, she refused. Why did she refuse? He sees both ideas. The tzara'at or the tail. Finally, next, number eight, we know that there's Memuchan. Memuchan was the advisor that advises Achashverosh to kill Vashti, right? And Chazal say, who was Memuchan? Haman, right? So here you see Rav Elazar of Worms shows Memucha, Begematria, Hine Haman, behold it's Haman, right? They both equal 155. And then the next one, if this is a little different, number 9. So at the end of the first paragraph of the Megillah, Ahasuerus sends out his letter to all the countries that the man is the head of the household and everyone should speak the language of their nation. And in the Gemara, Chazal explained that the people received this letter, they thought it was very foolish. They got this impression of Ahasuerus that he was sort of this foolish king with like strange demands, like what kind of letter was this? And the Gemara explains that this was all even something so innocent in the first parak that doesn't seem directly related to the Jewish people was really part of Hashem's plan. That this letter was sent out and all the people sort of squinted and said, wow, our king's a little strange. And this helped the Jewish people because then later on when they got the next proclamation that all the Jewish people were going to be killed, the people of the lands didn't take it as seriously as they might have if they hadn't received the first letter because they sort of felt like, oh, our king and his kind of ridiculous proclamations that he makes, okay. So that you really see Yad Hashem in every aspect of the Megillah, even something in the first parak that seems really unrelated to the Jewish people was actually paving the way for their ultimately being saved. So Rav Elazar of Worms ties in this whole idea of Hashem being involved in every step, and he does this using what he calls the Shar Hikuf. This is one of his gates where what you do is you take a few words, you take the first letter of every word, and then you read them backwards. Okay, so look how this works. It says in this proclamation, Ki Rabahi v'chol hanashim yitznu. So in those words, if you look at Ki v'chol hanashim yitznu, so if you take the first letter of every word and read it backwards, you get Shem Havaya, Hashem's name, Yod Kei Vav Kei. You see that? So Rav Elazar of Worms actually shows now this whole idea, this whole drasha in the Gemara that Hashem is behind everything, even in this proclamation, he sees right there in the words. He shows how it's hinted to right there in the words. So anyway, I think it's pretty amazing. I hope you do too. And finally, the last example that I brought is just the beginning of the second parak, when Ahasuerus remembers his wife Vashti and what he decreed against her. So on the words Asher Nigzar, when he remembers the decree, so Rav Elazar of Worms shows that's Begematria B'Yom HaShabbos. One is 761, one is 760. So we had said that Chazal say because she made the girls work on Shabbos, she was punished on Shabbos. And Rav Elazar of Worms shows that that's in the actual words itself. Asher Nigzar, when was it Nigzar B'Yom HaShabbos? That she was, the decree went against her on Shabbos. So we see here that not only does Rav Elazar of Worms bring the ideas of Chazal, but he shows how it's one and the same with the words of the actual text of the Megillah. He shows how it's hinted to, and how if you look with the right eye and with the right tools, you can actually come to the ideas that Chazal said. So I think it's a beautiful testament to the magnificence of Torah and just the beautiful tapestry and how everything, right, as he says himself, what is there, right, what is there that Moshe didn't hint to in the Torah? Just a beautiful idea. And I guess in general, we always talk about Purim as being the holiday of the hidden, what's concealed, the story is all about things weren't clear. Esther means hidden, right? Anochi Haster Aster Panabi Omahu. Hashem says, you know, in difficult times, it always seems Hashem is hidden from us, right? That's so much the theme of Purim. So I thought it was appropriate to show how Rav Elazar of Worms shows that even in the text of the Megillah itself, there are things that are concealed, and there are ways to reveal them. So anyway, thank you so much again, Chodesh Tov, and it was really an honor to address you.